Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first of our February live broadcasts, our Learning with Others, delivered to you direct to your computer, to your desktop. I hope you found logging in easier this evening than you did before. Our little wizard Nathan has improved things yet again to make it just that bit simpler for you. I'm sure it was a lot simpler than it was for us getting into central London in the middle of this afternoon's traffic. We're here in central London to talk to Pippa Bark-Williams. Many of you may have heard of Pippa, some of you may have listened to her speak before. We're going to talk about issues around patient consent, informed consent, patient safety, some of the legal matters that may go behind that. Pippa is the Principal Research Fellow at University College London. She's had a long history of working with osteopaths and also working around the issues of patient consent. She co-authored a book in 2011, Patient Safety, Law, Policy and Practice, and she's done research into areas such as anticoagulation therapy and into the safety of electronic patient notes. And on top of all that, she's a mum. Pippa, welcome to our little studio this evening. Welcome to APM, and thank you for joining us to talk about these issues. I warned you I was going to ask this, but I have no idea what the day-to-day job or day-to-day work of a principal research fellow is. What do you do all day long? Are you chasing little white rats around a maze or something?
Not yet. Well, doctors, that can, can be very similar. The white bit is there. Typical things. So this week I worked with surgeons, so I went into hip surgery. And I stood next to men in spacesuits and peered into opened up bodies. Okay. And we were looking at how to make closing time faster, opening to closing skin time. Very practical. I'm a practical researcher. I'm from a health psychology background.
Yeah.
So as they open the patient, I get to lean in and nosy. I love it. Yeah. And then and just think about how do you make this faster, safer, more efficient.
But your background is as a psychologist originally?
Psychologist.
Yeah, so
last week I was working with patients looking at why they do or don't want access to patient records in intensive care.
Right, okay.
What are the patient's perspectives on this? So each week I try and do something useful and helpful for healthcare.
Yeah. And how did this long relationship with osteopathy start for you?
A limp.
Right. So I walked. Has it gone?
Yes, it has gone.
Oh, good.
The walk now is completely my own. Right. And so I walked with a limp. I looked like Spotty Dog. And so arms and legs went alternately. Yeah. And a very excellent Southend osteopath changed my life.
Excellent. Well, I hope that Southend osteopath is watching, and well done if you are. You've also done quite a bit of work with the General Chiropractic Council, haven't you? So I do have to ask, what's the difference between an osteopath and a chiropractor? Because everyone always asks us.
You get better food at the General College of Chiropractic.
Oh, God.
Much better food. And they called me Mom. It's the only time in my life I've been called Mom.
Right.
So I've got huge respect for them on that basis alone.
We were with Tim Walker only a few weeks ago. Tim, if you're watching this one, we want better food next time we come back to Osteopathy House.
And if you could all call me Mom.
And we'll call you Mom.
Yeah, maybe walk backwards.
Shouldn't it be Ma'am to rhyme with jam? Apparently that's what the Queen says. So
Happy with that too.
I'll go along with it. It's her English after all. So. We're here to do some live Learning with Others CPD. Remember that blue button at the bottom right-hand side of the screen. If you click on there, you can ask us questions. Keep them coming in because it makes it much more entertaining for both of us here. And, of course, it's what makes this Learning with Others. Pippa, you're going to talk to us about patient consent. So,
I am, and I'm talking about it from a psychologist's perspective.
Right.
The legal facts you can get by looking at your policy documents, and I will steer people to those if they're not aware, ready, aware of updates. But the main thing I want to talk about is fear of the law and why it shouldn't get in the way of practice.
And it does come up an awful lot. It came up when we were talking to Tim Walker a few weeks ago. It comes up when you talk to other osteopaths in practice that actually we are increasingly, I think, concerned about the what we see as a culture of litigation, that if there's any possible chink in our armour, that there are certain types of patients who might exploit that. Although, of course, the incidence of complaints are very, very low against osteopaths, and I presume
and
for
the
chiropractors
And the incidence of litigation is not increasing chiropractic or osteopathy.
Right. Okay.
There will occasionally be a patient who will sue or will complain. Mm. We're not going to avoid that. But what we're talking about today is having confidence in good practice,
right.
Not in avoiding litigation,
yes.
Not in being defensive, but just good practice.
Okay. So. Well, I know you've got a few slides for us, so should we get your presentation underway? And I'm going to interrupt you with either questions from our audience or questions of my own devising as we go along,
Much
if that's all right with you, ma'am.
Yes,
right.
Ma'am's rhyme a jam. Cool. So, fear of legal framework. This is something that came up. We were doing a series of talks around the country about looking at risks and benefits when you're talking to patients about their treatments. And people were constantly talking as if consent was separate from the main process of clinical treatment, not an integral part. So, one of my points is to soothe feathers that it's not separate. Consenting is not a legal thing. It's just part of your normal decision making. Mm. It's part of how you deal with patients. And on the whole, you do it very well.
Okay.
So if we look at the kind of framework, and there have been various mild updates, so the NHS site is the most sensible one I could come across, consent to treatment, and if you look at the overhead legal framework, there it is. The patient needs to be informed, it needs to be voluntary decisions, and it can be oral, doesn't need to be written. It doesn't need to have these pseudo-legal documents that people are starting to use out of fear.
Yeah, I think that came as a bit of a surprise to me and to others, listening to Tim Walker talking a few weeks ago, that actually, you know, lots of us are devising these forms to go into our case histories where patients consent to treatment. Now, I know you can't consent to treatment, you know, in a single statement, you know, because what happens 3 weeks, 3 months down the line might be different, but, you know, we've got bits of paper for all sorts of things to consent. He was saying that's not necessary at all.
Not at all
actually
necessary.
Our notes to say that we've explained the risks are sufficient.
Yes, you writing what you've done is vital.
Yes.
But they don't have to write anything. And there's, you know, people are now, I've been looking on, you know, various people's practice, and people are coming up with these forms either to give people before they come into clinic or to do as part of clinic. And for many, I think that'll disrupt your practice and won't increase your sense of trust with the patient at all.
No, and I think it's a slight digression. I think the same is the case with some of the outcome measures that we try to report as well, because as part of the NHS contract that we have to produce outcome measures, and it means that we have to sit a patient down behind a form when actually all they want is to get their problem fixed. But they're sitting down behind a form with not complicated questions, but some patients still struggle with these written questions, and yet we have to do that if we're going to get anything that's even vaguely like an objective answer from it. And it's not good for the relationship at all. But at least we try to do that in the waiting room rather than as part of their consultation. Sorry, I interrupted you, ma'am.
Well,
yeah, I'm not going to stop now.
But I think I'm going to move on to my next slide here, where in terms of the kind of like the basic legal stuff, the documentation has really improved in the last 3 years. And that's, I think, for all the manual therapies. So the Care Quality Commission gave some new documents, but so did each. So osteopaths, chiropractors, physiotherapists have all updated their documents. And in particular, the osteopaths have given some very nice documents for capacity to consent for each separate part of Britain, and anyone can go and use those as well.
Yes.
So even if you're a chiropractor, you can go and,
go
and dig into those. So if you're sort of worried about the sort of process, that's all now written out much, much more clearly than it was 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Very nice to see. And so I don't need to do that bit, is my point.
Good. Okay. What we'll do after this is we'll make sure that as part of our summary, the reference, that the link that goes directly to those references is available to anyone logging into the website to save them having to dig it out for themselves.
So part of those documents, and I think this is where people get more anxious, is about the wording. And again, this is where people get hooked up. So the main principles about giving patients information is they have to be able to understand it.
Hmm.
And that can be for everyone. It's about grading the language, writing it out simply, doing it as people normally do. There's nothing special about consenting that is different to your basic training as a therapist. I think where people get anxious is when people talk about benefits and risks.
Mm.
And there's different wording for different documents. But for example, osteopaths say any material or significant risks. And people start to kind of think, well, anything that could possibly go wrong, No. It's material or significant risks.
Yes.
So chiropractors have any foreseeable risks, which sounds, again, quite frightening. You know, how are you meant to foresee anything, everything? But it's what the patient needs to know for them in their circumstances, and then the project becomes much smaller.
Yes.
So I think it's not being so fearful. And people aren't looking to jump on people's backs to say, you should have told them everything. They're saying, what do they need to know in their circumstance? No crystal balls.
Yeah. But I think I read, I don't know if it was on the GOSC website or whether it was something Tim said the other week. It might even have been something I was reading about you in preparation for this interview. You don't have to give them all the risks. You have to give them the risks which are relevant to the treatment that you're doing. Otherwise, you know.
Yes.
And I have to say, I'm guilty of probably, before I treat any patient for the first time, I warn them about the theoretical risks of cervical manipulation. And I get that out of the way straight away, because I think that one is a potential obstacle to treatment, because if they're really worried about treatment, then they're going to decline it. But get it out of the way early, and maybe in the back of my mind I'm thinking, by the time I come around to actually do this, they'll have had time to get used to me, feel more confident in me, and therefore they'll be more comfortable with the idea of me applying a treatment which I have said could cause
Absolutely.
Damage.
Absolutely.
But is that unfair? I mean, is this a rare but severe risk like that?
Yeah. You can present in a way that it's very low anxiety producing, and we'll look later on some graphics on that.
Okay, I don't want to preempt what you're going to say later, but.
But on the whole, the most important ones for the patients are about day-to-day stuff, what they can expect. And a lot of these are called risks in the osteopathic and chiropractic literature. Normally we just call them side effects. So a bit of stiffness, tiredness, slight dizziness. And so one of the things you're thinking about is how to make it normal language that patients expect.
Yes.
So if you say the risk of treatment, it already is quite anxiety provoking. If you say, well, you might get a bit stiff afterwards, might be a bit of pulling, it's like, okay, that sounds very different, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
And so one of the things I would like to see change in osteopathy and chiropractic is a softening of the language and removing the sort of pseudo-legal jargon that we really don't need. So out with risks, out with, you know, kind of like percentages, which often don't mean very much for patients.
But I suppose, I mean, if I were a patient, it doesn't mean much to me if you say there's a low risk of something nasty happening. I mean, because if there's a risk, there's a risk. I could be that low percentage, couldn't I?
Yes.
How do you make sure that they're getting the right information when you do this?
You're preempting, because we're going to come up with pairing words and numbers.
All right, okay, good.
But yes, you do need to know what you're letting yourself in for.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that's what this is about, isn't it? It's explaining to the person what they're letting themselves in for, and making sure they really agree to what you can and can't. So other things we're talking about on our slide is likely outcomes, and that's about if they have your care or if they don't have your care.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a difference? You know, you're hoping there is, and you're hoping the outcomes are positive.
Yeah.
But you may not be able to guarantee it. So you're also working with them about dealing with the unknown, dealing with uncertainty. Now, chiropractors in their documentation talk about what people are involved in the care as well, which osteopaths don't have as a specific point. Seems to me a very sensible thing. As a patient, this is something I like to know. Who is going to be there with me?
Okay.
And who might I expect to talk to?
Do you think that's because osteopaths think that's fairly obvious? You're in a room with me, I'm the person who's going to be with you? Or do you mean they can bring others in as chaperones? Or do you mean...
They might do. There might be someone else they want to involve. Or if it's only them, so it's only them. That's very useful to know too.
Right.
So no surprises is what you're going for.
Mm-hmm.
And so, next slide. It all sounds so easy. I think you read these consenting documents and you think as easy can be. But there's emotions. There's emotions from the patients, but there are emotions from the practitioner. And I think for some practitioners, there's a sense that this is getting in the way of their practice, or it will be too time-consuming, or it's somehow breaking the softness of the encounter. What I'd like to get across today is it shouldn't change the encounter in any way. By preparing someone for what to expect and reaching agreement, it should soften the encounter. It's a good thing.
Okay.
It's a very, very helpful thing. So these sort of things that come up are patients' anxiety. So when you are consenting them, they may have only just found out about their diagnosis. So it's giving people a pause for thought, a pause to get used to something you've given them. Mm. Or if you offer them more than one option about the way of dealing with it, for some patients that can make them anxious. So we'll be looking at some of the wording that might help to soften that. No one feels things the same. So for one patient, what's emotional, what's difficult, what's hard to understand might be easy for another. So we're dealing with that. And we're trying to set realistic expectations of what will come out of the treatment and in terms of benefits and what might be the side effects.
Is it your experience that osteopaths, chiropractors, physiotherapists are good at interpreting which patients understand, which patients appreciate these things, or is there a vast mix of our understanding of the patient?
I think there's a vast mix. There's some are absolutely brilliant at it, and some are rustier. But I think one thing is much of the information you have has become so automatic and obvious for you that you forget to tell the patient.
Yes.
You know, so it's a bit of stiffness after manipulation is too obvious to mention. And yet for a patient, that's very, very significant.
Well, in fact, the other day, I mean, we brought up the fact that because we work with people in their underwear all the time, to us it's very easy to overlook that this might be quite a shock to a new patient, that I've got to take my clothes off.
And, absolutely.
And you do forget the simplest of things because we're so familiar with them.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I remember myself as a patient where my first encounter with an osteopath, my underwear was normal, and I spent the whole time he was trying to explain things to me tucking and pulling. So the second time I was prepared and I dressed like someone ready for a polar expedition, and as he pulled my knees up and he was trying to do a good and solid twist on me, all I could think about was how the polar explorer's underwear was getting in the way. I listened to not a word he was saying, and I'd worked for osteopaths for years before that encounter. And
I work with a lovely osteopath in London, and in Kentish Town, and a patient has produced for him a picture which he's put on the wall, which is the patient's guide to the appropriate underwear to wear. And you know, it's the sort of thing you couldn't do yourself because
I need a copy of this.
It's totally politically incorrect, or people would regard it as inappropriate, but a patient produced it, so he put it on the wall, and it's very useful. Yeah. I'll ask him if he can have a copy.
I mean, one thing I ask people to do is, because you've lost your inhibitions about talking to partially dressed people, is to imagine yourself in your accountant's office partially dressed while they're talking about your tax returns and how much information you could take in those circumstances.
Yes, that's
very sobering,
change,
isn't it? Particularly with my accountant.
Yeah. Well, I have a lovely accountant called Kate, but even so, Kate, I don't want to find myself in your office in my underwear talking about my annual accounts, I'm afraid. So.
Realistic expectations I mentioned as well. Yeah. Now, realistic expectations of the benefits apply as much to the practitioner as to the patient. When the patient comes in, what we're really looking for is a complete cure, completely pain-free, a full range of motion, and the ability to do sports to a level that we couldn't before we had the injury. So all that's a kind of hopeful assumption. As a practitioner, I think what you're hoping for is to be able to deliver miracles. And so part of the process is that both of you have to come to a point of realism, that the benefits of your treatment might be slightly improved pain, a slight improvement in range of movements. It's not a complete fix in many cases. And that's quite a hard thing to say when you want to reassure someone right from the beginning.
Yeah.
So it's saying that in a way that feels like a good thing.
Yes, and you're probably going to talk about this, but is that done by assessing what the likely outcome measures will be right at the outset of treatment?
Yes.
This is what would be an acceptable outcome for you as my patient, and then we'll say, well, we'll work to that. Hopefully, we'll do better than that. But it is possibly unusual to get a complete fix in certain cases.
Yes. And what's acceptable for you as a practitioner? Mm. Would you be willing to treat this person knowing that this is the only benefit you might get?
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
So it's a two-way process. In terms of talking about benefits and risks, and I'll keep reinforcing, you know, our natural language is to say risks and benefits, but benefits should always come first. There's no area of business where you talk about your risks before you've sold your benefits.
But hang on. Don't you want to leave the nice thought in their mind rather than the nasty one?
Pros and cons. You know, you don't say, do come in, this is what could go wrong, but it might work. You always start by going, I think I can help you. This would be great. On the other hand, there are things to bear in mind.
Right.
So start with the benefits, otherwise everyone will flee the room. Benefits first.
All right.
And that is also in information sheets and information letters. I've been to a lot of practices where people hammer out the risks to such an extent you think, why would anyone go to an osteopath or a chiropractor? Mm. Well, actually, because they work a lot of the time.
Yes.
You know, so that's a really good starting point.
We always wonder why anybody consents to surgery, don't you, after you've signed so many forms saying that this could kill you.
Absolutely. But it works.
Yes.
But most of the time.
Yeah.
So. And when you do talk about risks, they tend to be over-amplified by people most of the time. So you might say to someone, there's a 1% chance or a 0.0% chance, and people can very quickly get wary of that if you use that language of risk and percentage. So you need to think about, do I want them to be that wary about that, or do I just want them to know that it's a small possibility in a range of outcomes?
Yes.
So it's balance. So you talked about the vulnerability of being undressed. There's also the vulnerability of lying down. So again, if you're lying on your accountant's desk, you're much less likely to listen than if you're sitting up as we are now, side by side. And this is, again, something you've got so used to, you forget what humanoids feel like on this. So it's just a reminder of the obvious. Timing of information, again, people deliver a diagnosis and go straight into decision making, where we need thinking time. And we're not talking hours, we're talking seconds usually. And I think often when I deliver these kind of lectures, people say, we haven't got time for this. We're not talking hours, we're talking seconds, minutes, just a bit of dust settling time.
Yeah.
Which makes a huge difference. And of course, the way the information is relayed, and we'll be talking more about words versus numbers, but there's a very nice new article by Trivana et al. In 2013 that's worth going up on and just having a read through.
Okay. It always amazes me about academics. You trot out these references like this, and you must remember thousands of these things.
Well, I've chosen two today.
Okay.
I've chosen one that's a very nice one and by Elvin, which is talking about a decision-making model.
Mm-hmm.
And what's nice about it is, before, when I talked to osteopaths about risk information, they said it was very nice to have these, you know, like sensible outlines, but actually they wanted some detail about the kind of wording. Well, Elvin's written a paper that under each stage it gives you example sentences.
Okay.
And I'm going to throw out some of those today.
Good.
They may or may not work for you, but it's worth a go. And sometimes reading someone else's suggestion and thinking, I would never say something like that, it'll clarify in your mind what you would say. And I think for that alone, the paper's useful.
Okay.
Some of the vocabulary is a bit cheesy, but you'll have to forgive them for that. So, setting the scene for my next slide, just a quick summary. So, sitting, keep your patient not too naked, blanket around the shoulders. Give them time, get them calm. And the kind of phrases that help to kind of like move from this point where you've given them a diagnosis to preparing to think about what are the options, how do you begin the process of consenting, can be something very gentle like, now that we've identified the problem, it's time to think about what to do next. So you're beginning that instantly by some time, and it prepares them. And this is the sort of phrases that seem to work well.
Can I just take you back? You started off saying, sit them down, towel around their shoulders or whatever. Now, are you saying that they need that because actually that's a sensible thing to do because they feel much more comfortable if they're not sitting in their underwear trying to talk to you and answer questions? Or are you saying that that will influence the type of answer that they give because they're feeling vulnerable? Are they more likely to say yes to treatment or no to treatment because they're half naked?
It will reduce the efficacy of consent.
Okay.
If it's changing them in any way, if they're feeling self-conscious or they're feeling, well, we started so I can't possibly say no now, it's not fully informed consent. Consent is about being neutral and allowing them to make choices to go on with the treatment, to stop the treatment, to change the treatment. Next slide. So I talked about one possible way of looking at this is to do a decision-making model. And Elvin and Crowd talk about a three-stage model. The first stage, they talk about talking through choices. They call this choice talk. Right. So I always get a bit, kind of like, it sounds a bit cheesy, isn't it, when people give these kind of like buzzwords. But actually, the structure is very helpful. Mm-hmm. So offering choice. And the first thing people worry about here is, what about suspicious patients who instantly think, well, if you're giving me choices, shouldn't you know? You're the expert. Don't you know what you're doing? Are you a fumbling idiot? Mm-hmm. So you need a phrase to show that you are not incompetent, you are actually very professional. And this is where something like, there's good information about how these treatments differ that I'd like to discuss with you. So okay. You've got the confidence to say there are options and you'd like to talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our first thing, to knocking out the incompetency fears. And making it clear that it's about this patient that you're consenting. So things like, treatments have different consequences. Some will matter more to you than to other people. So I would like to discuss these with you.
Right. Yep.
Now, these might seem blatantly obvious, these kind of suggestions, but I like them because as a practitioner, you can look at them and think, yeah, I do have patients who get touchy at this point. I'll try that sentence. Yep. Or, actually, it's never been a problem with me. I'm not going to bother with that stage. It's just a choice for practitioners. Uncertainty. So I think more and more practitioners are getting used to the idea of discussing uncertainty with patients, and the idea that you're not meant to be God who knows everything, but that you do have access to things.
Yes.
They're not guarantees, but they're your best chance. And so I think there is a cultural change with this. But if it's something that you're not so comfortable with, then sorts of phrases can be things like, treatments are not always effective and the chance of experiencing side effects vary for different people and vary for different conditions. Mm. So I would like to run through these with you.
Yeah, okay.
Even doctors do this now. Even doctors discuss uncertainty. One of the things we talked about 5 years ago was that osteopaths and chiropractors were setting a bar that was almost higher than doctors.
They in were terms of communication with patients?
In terms of expecting there to be certainty.
That might be me.
In terms of expecting a way of conveying information and facts. That, I mean, most of medicine isn't that evidence-based. Not rigorous randomised control trial evidence-based. And yet we were expecting greater things. So I know the chiropractors went through a dreadful amount of stuff about their advertising campaigns, about proving things were evidence-based that I was involved in. And we kept going, but medicine or psychotherapists don't necessarily have evidence for everything they advertise. So, as a culture.
I see what you mean. I thought we were setting the bar high. You meant we were setting the bar high by insisting that we explain everything to our patients, because of course the conventional medical world had a reputation for many years of being very arrogant in the way they handled their patients, and that what the doctor told you was what was going to happen whether you liked it or not.
Yeah.
And of course they have changed a lot. They've had to change a lot, and I think probably most of them wanted to change and get away from that model. Yes, but I do see what you mean now. Yeah. Sorry.
Yes. So we're much more comfortable with the idea of working with the patient, in effect. And the last stage of this, which I think for some people is obvious, but not all, is about checking the patient's reaction at this stage. And at this point, a few patients might be disconcerted or start to express concern. And this is where you have the chance of just pausing. Should we go on? Shall I tell you more about this?
Mm.
And again, just giving them a choice about what speed to go at. And all these things, well, on the face of it, might make you fearful that it'll take too long and you actually need to get on and deal with the clinical things. These are time-saving things. And when people do use these kind of models, it actually saves time because you're not then dealing with a stiff, anxious patient or a patient who suddenly wants to withdraw or back off from the process.
Yeah. That's
moving on to alternatives. Again, I think one of the concerns previously, where the advice was explain any alternatives to the treatment. It doesn't mean every single alternative on the planet. It means the reasonable, frequently used alternatives. So you might have manipulation, you might have exercise, you might have watching to see what happens.
Yeah.
In the end, patients say they want the most effective treatment for their condition. So what you're teaching them is what's likely to be the most effective treatment. And if there's two equally effective treatments, or if we're not quite sure which will work best for them, that's the ones you're laying out to them.
Yeah.
So it won't drive people away. The way you phrase it is going to be your most helpful thing. So by comparing one obvious treatment with another, it should be quite reassuring. But if you look at the kind of documentation I'm still seeing in some information sheets, by making it jargoned or too highfalutin, it adds confusion rather than clarity. So, for example, I read in one information leaflet, for pain, manipulation has a comparable risk to exercise or analgesic drugs and is less less risky than prolonged use of analgesics.
Right.
Well, as a patient, I'm thinking, run that past me one more time. As a researcher, I kind of know what you mean. But actually, to have written that in ordinary layman's language, the risks of increased pain are about the same if I do this treatment as if you did exercise. As a patient, I get that straight away.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think when people are writing information leaflets, they get frightened that it should somehow sound more scientific or more legal, rather than just using the language you would anyway.
Yeah.
And informed consent is just about making sure someone understands what they're getting into.
That's going to be surely more the case if we're writing something down. When you give somebody a form to sign their consent, you know, the temptation there surely is to say, I, the undersigned, hereby acknowledge that I have been... You wouldn't do that, but you know what I mean.
People do. They do a pseudo-legal document that has no validity.
But if we're just doing oral consent, as you said, is sensible and is all that's necessary, then, of course, we're not going to write the exact words we used in our notes anyway. We're going to talk to the patient, explain what we think is going on, and then, I don't know, maybe have a standard abbreviation that says explained the risks and obtained consent. You may be talking about whether the merits or the legalities of having abbreviations for that sort of thing later. I don't know, because you've done a lot on patient notes, haven't you?
Yeah.
But there's much less temptation to do that, surely, if it's just oral consent, because I'm not going to say to you now, do you acknowledge that I have said to you...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But in written thing, there's nothing that means that you can't have it in layperson's language.
No. Okay.
So... far preferable. And hopefully, you know, it'll increase confidence in the patient.
Yeah.
And if you say to someone, you know, I'm not the best person for this particular thing, you will get a better effect from a different profession. We have plenty of anecdotal evidence to say patients do leave at that point and then they come back and they refer on other people.
Right.
It increases your credibility, increases their trust. Mm. This is someone who knows what they're good at and who knows for my condition what would be even better for that circumstance.
Right.
For my next slide, so some patients don't like this idea of a shared decision model, and we've all had a scenario where people go, I don't know, what would you do? And indeed, I am that patient. Mm. So, and there's ways of dealing with this. You know, in terms of informed consent, you need to give them the options and you need to convince them. So far we talked about saying it's different for different patients. So already they see it's something that might be relevant to them. At this point, when you're hoping that they'll help you with the decision and they go, I don't want to, you can defer for a moment. Just give them a breathing point. Find out what concerns they've still got and make it clear to them, I'm happy to share my views and help you get a good decision.
Mm-hmm.
But before I do, can I just describe the options that I'm going through in my head? They might go, well, no. But most of the time they go, okay, yeah, run them past me. For me, I've been in a situation where when I've got to the decision point, I've said to the clinician, I don't know, what would you do if this was your child? I am people's heart sink patient. And I've had clinicians say to me, well, yeah, I would take this course of action if it were my child. Joy of joys, my next question is, so do you have a child? You know, can you imagine how your heart sinks dealing with me? And they go, no.
Yes.
Actually, a better point for them to say at this point would be, what is it that you're worrying about? Why are you hesitating on this choice? Because that's what I'm saying to them. I'm not saying I want you to make my decision. I'm saying I'm not convinced. I'm looking for something extra to convince me. And when clinicians do say that, they just pause and go, I would do it for my child, but it's not the point. Why are you worried about it? that's when we have the useful discussion. Yes. I don't think you've taken into account this, or I'm concerned that maybe it's different to what you're describing to me.
Yeah.
That's where I go. I'm glad I don't have me as a patient. But I think one thing people say is, when patients say, tell me what to do, they're assuming that the patient doesn't want to make the decision. And that may be the case, but it may not. Mm-hmm. Don't close the door quite so fast. So the next stage is about options, looking through options. And again, Elwyn has given us examples, which are very nice. They're on the slide, if you'd like to go through this. So it's about checking knowledge. You said, do we as practitioners know when to, how much information to give our patients?
Yes.
And I think one of our most difficult patient group is experts, either because they're an expert in their own condition, or they seem to be very well informed, or perhaps they're a professor. Mm. So I work with a professor of anaesthetics. I assumed she knew more than me on everything. I was working this week with a professor of hip surgery. I assumed he knew more about hip surgery than I did. But actually, we had different perspectives, and checking with each other got us very, very different information.
Yes.
So our first thing is checking, even for our very, very well-informed patients.
Yeah, and I suspect a lot of osteopaths have a little frisson of nervousness when they know that a GP is coming to see them. Because,
absolutely,
of course, you want to impress the GP with what you can do. You always have that horrible worry that they may have something which won't respond to your treatment. But you do have the, we are all aware of the depth and extent of a GP's training, so we assume that they know an awful lot of things that perhaps we don't. And yet, I have had GPs say to me that our knowledge as osteopaths is vastly greater than theirs on musculoskeletal conditions, and that shouldn't be a surprise to us.
Yeah.
But
and they've come to you because you've got a different knowledge base,
yeah,
so you shouldn't be frightened of sharing that.
Yeah.
So again, you know, with your heart sink patient, if they are a GP, then it's checking, and that's how you check without feeling patronising in any way. So what have you heard or read about it? Or I don't go over old ground, can I check what you know? So just using phrases. And similarly, if you think they've got something, keeping the onus on yourself, but not being frightened to double check it with them. So, you know, kind of like, to make sure that I've explained this clearly, would it be okay to ask you to repeat back to me?
Mm.
Not to say, can you repeat back to me, which sounds like a test, but to ask their permission to make sure that you've done your job properly. And these, again, I think, they're very simple tools, but they're things that make a difference in checking that you're going through options logically.
Yes.
Does this seem very obvious?
On the one hand, a lot of it does seem obvious, but there are some points which come out of this. I mean, the use of language, the things that you've described, I think, are actually very helpful. And some of it might, many of the people watching might find very reassuring. Well, yes, they think I'm doing that, so that's
which
good.
Which is perfect.
But without your confirmation, many of us will still be worrying about how we get informed consent from patients in a way which would satisfy an inquiry by the General Counsel if someone were to complain. And I think that's why this type of training is becoming mandatory for osteopaths, because it's one of the four themes which they will insist that we all do as part of our three-year cycle. And it is, it's very important, isn't it? I mean, communication is not simple, whether it's technical jargon, whether it's your patient's competence to understand, or whether it's the degree to which we have somehow influenced that patient. I mean, all those things need to be taken into account. And we're not psychologists, you are. So you can tell us what we're doing to get that right or wrong.
Worrying.
Yeah, exactly.
It's what you're doing. I think some of the language thing comes about in terms of giving options. As a practitioner, you often have a very favourite option and an obvious direction that you know in your heart of hearts you would like them to go for. So part of what informed consent is allowing people to make a decision even if it's not the same as yours.
Mm.
So that's the painful part. Or, not falling into the trap of deliberately biasing the options.
Yeah.
So people will say, I can treat you, and that's good for me in my business, or we can just wait and see what happens. Now, wait and see what happens sounds like a very poor second cousin. Whereas actually, you could phrase those equally well by saying, if I treat you, these will be the benefits and the possible risks. On the other hand, we could do watchful waiting, or whatever phrase you like to use, active observation, and see what happens over the next few weeks.
Yes, I think that's a tough one for osteopaths and for lots of other medical practitioners generally, because if I go and see my GP, I haven't paid any money, and my GP can say, well, I don't want to do anything about this now, come back and see me in 2 weeks' time, and neither of us is out of pocket on that. When a patient comes to see an osteopath, a chiropractor or so on, actually they're paying money for you to tell them not to do anything, or that you're not going to do anything, and you know, and we all worry that patients want something done for them, and it doesn't feel as though you're doing something for them if all you're doing is giving that expert advice that we don't want to do anything now. And that's not to say we don't do it, but I think that that thought is always going through our minds, that you know, the patient is expecting us to do something for them at this point, and watchful waiting doesn't count.
Well, that's why you're giving them the choice, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you can say, I can do something, or we can watch and wait. And they will tell you. On the whole, you've already won, because they're there with you now. So they're likely to want to stay with you. But for some people, it will increase their confidence in you, that they think, he hasn't pushed treatment on me, he's given me a clear diagnosis, he's given me a plan, he's given me a time frame, I'll come back in 2 weeks if nothing's changed. And he hasn't gone for my money. And it will increase the long-term kind of respect.
Yes.
So one thing people do is they feel they have to lay everything on you in one go.
I like the heading of this, personalised chunk and summarise.
Chunk is such a satisfying word. So we talked about benefits, so managing expectations, everyone's. So it may not be a complete cure, it may not be freedom from pain, it may not be a return to full mobility. Mm-hmm. The next thing is about chunking. Elwin will give you particular ways of dealing with this, but it's about breaking it down into pieces and giving people enough time to absorb each part. So benefits. So if someone's in incredible pain and you say, I can reduce your pain, it may not fix it completely, or I can increase your range of movement, but we might be talking a small amount, maybe enough for you to raise your arm but not enough to play the violin. That's useful to know, but you need a pause before they then go on to say all the other things, the pros and cons.
Okay.
You will see people doing this in clinic where they think, I've got to go through the risks and benefits now, and they hurtle through the whole lot to the point it becomes meaningless. So I've been in this scenario where both timing and information giving was terrifying, where I was on an operating trolley being run down the corridor with them shouting out risks of death to me as we ran down the corridor. You have a 1% risk of this and you have a 0.0 something of that. And they just listed all the ways I might die, suffer or lose bits of my body.
Right.
Clearly, as informed consent, it was never going to stand up to scrutiny later on had I been worried about it. I wasn't particularly worried about it. I'd kind of committed at that stage to living. But I think on a more minor level.
Well, that sounds actually, death is a good outcome, isn't it? Because you can't complain then. So that sounds, in the inquiry, they'll say, well, we did it all perfectly
it's
rationally.
It's cheaper than long-term disability.
Yeah.
but in terms of most work, you do see people piling out the risks and benefits in one mouthful. So that's what chunking is about, breaking things up. Decision tools can help. And by decision tools, I don't mean anything fancy, although there are some things. Sometimes just drawing out lists for people, or drawing, if you do this, this is what happens. If you do that, this is what happens, just helps people to think more quickly. And control how your presentation biases the perception, numbers and words coming up. The stage, again, that we tend to rush over because we want to crack on with the treatment is summarising and checking. And may I check that I explain that clearly by asking you just to feedback very quickly to me what I've said.
Do you think there's a subconscious desire on the part of a lot of practitioners that you want to rush over these things? Because we reckon we know what's best, and we don't want to give you, we don't put the fear of God up you, because we want you to say yes to treatment.
So absolutely.
It's not that we just...
And you like fixing things, so you want to get on and fix things.
Yeah, and, but it's I don't know if I'm... I mean, there is a subtle difference here, that yes, we want to get on and do the fixing, but also we want to influence your decision by rushing through the pros and cons, the benefits and risks, because if we do that, then we can get on with the fixing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we want to do. We want to get on with it. So, and actually, when you look at the amount of time this takes, we're talking a couple of minutes. Mm. You know, as we go through every minor stage, it sounds like a huge task. It's not. Mm. You know, I just keep coming back to the, you know, kind of like, do they know what they're getting into? That's the only thing informed consent is really about.
I don't remember experiencing any of this, and I'm not having a dig at any GPs who might be watching us or may hear of this, but I don't remember anything like this sort of procedure being followed in the GP's surgery. Now, I know they've only got 10 or 12 minutes to deal with each patient, but you know, there isn't time to chunk and summarise, is there? They, you know, you need pills, here they are, here's your prescription.
They don't go through the risks and benefits. They don't tell you the likelihood of outcome.
Yeah.
So you ask me...
I think the only area they do, actually, is in back pain, because now they're required, if you get this score on the sheets under an NHS contract, they're required to say, no, you've got to go away and wait for 6 weeks. If you get this score, then you can go and see a manual practitioner, a chiropractor, osteopath, physio, and if you get this score, then you go to the multidisciplinary
team.
So that's
the thing.
Yeah.
Well,
but it's only that. But if I'm there for drugs, no, it's here's your prescription and away you go.
Well, I've been doing some work on over-prescribing of antibiotics, and a fascinating area, I think.
Yes.
And never, ever have I been told by a GP what's the point of antibiotics.
Yeah.
And so one of my thoughts is either you have the antibiotics or you die a long and slow and painful death. Assume that's why we took them. I mean, maybe that's slightly exaggerating, but you know, the idea that either you take them or you don't get cured.
Yes.
Whereas apparently the only difference between antibiotics and nothing in most cases is one day recovery.
Mm.
So if you have a strep throat, in most cases it's the difference between however many days with plus one without.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's it? Because if people had told me that was the effectiveness of antibiotics, I don't think I'd ever bother. And nowhere does that come up in the public engagement literature.
Yes. And of course, the other thing, and again, this really is a digression, but it goes back to what you were just saying, the business about people. I don't recall ever being told that I must finish a course of antibiotics recently, but the reasoning behind that is to try to prevent bacteria from evolving, isn't it?
Now, because if you can kill them, doing that now,
if you can kill them all, then they can't evolve, they can't strengthen, and therefore take all the antibiotics, even though we don't like to kill every bit of bacteria, but you can always put the good stuff back again. Anyway.
Well, you see, that's a classic case where now when you go to a practice, they bang out the risks about not continuing it, but they don't talk about the benefits about the point of taking the antibiotics in the first place. Onwards. So giving the patients the information they need in a way they can understand, our next slide. Now this is where we talk about any material or significant risks or any foreseeable risks.
Right.
And that's quite a lot. So here we go. Before I start, I should mention that common side effects are pain, discomfort, headache, tiredness, fatigue, radiating pain or discomfort, paresthesia, dizziness, nausea, stiffness, hot skin, fainting, early or heavy menstruation. I worry about you in particular on this one. Epigastric pain, tremor, palpitation and perspiration. Any questions?
Yeah.
So this is what we're in danger of doing if we take it, referring back to the previous, any material risk sounds like that. Of course, it's not what we mean. We mean relevant to that patient.
Yeah, I was feeling a bit like the actor in that film called Fish Called Wanda. Do you remember? Was it Kevin Costner?
I can't do foreign accents.
Whenever he was whenever anything was explained to him, he said, "What was the middle part again?" And actually, with that, there's a big middle part that I didn't follow at all when you ran through.
That's huge. So really, what is it for this person that needs doing? Mm. And you know, again, on information sheets, if those can be honed in any way, patients keep saying that if you're going to give them an information sheet, is there any way it could be honed for them? You know, kind of like, you know, could we have general information sheets? So particularly for elderly patients or particularly for lower back pain patients
or
particularly
patients,
for children or pregnant or people are craving more specific information.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to know what the risks are for everyone.
Most of them have got the risks from Google before they come to see us, haven't they?
Yeah, and terrifying. Yeah. Terrifying they are.
Yeah.
Because again, most research doesn't discriminate between, you know, someone very healthy with a minor ailment and someone very, very vulnerable with osteoporosis and crumbling and needing a very, very different approach. So have confidence about picking the risks that are relevant to the patient, but also talking. If you take that phrase, I should mention that common side effects are pain, discomfort, headache. Take away any language that makes it sound worse. You may feel a bit of discomfort. You may feel some pain. There's a difference between pain and discomfort. So if you know it's going to be painful, mention pain. If you know there's going to be stiffness, talk about stiffness. Yes. And trying to get the language specific and helpful to people.
Yeah.
So no shocks, but also no added fear. And people talk quite a bit about, in some of the GCC cases about consent, they said if they'd known they were going to feel woozy, they wouldn't have driven.
Mm.
So is that something so obvious that people have forgotten to mention it nowadays? Is it worthwhile? I know some people have practices where after the treatment you just sit down for a few minutes afterwards and have a glass of water before you leave.
Mm.
Practitioners cracked on with the next patient. So again, if you know that for certain treatments dizziness is likely,
yes,
having that built, yeah, in to your plan. So what patients want, my next slide, is the same as all the things we've been talking about. So Leach did a nice study in 2011, particularly for osteopaths. Now, they reported to her that what they're looking for is the most effective, but also the most cost-effective treatment. So that's part of what they need to know when you're consenting them. Is this the cheapest way of getting better?
Gosh, that's a tough one, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Now, they've chosen to come to you, and on the whole, they're not going to walk out of the room. But it is part of their mind frame. They're looking for the benefits. They're looking to know what to expect, particularly on the first visit. But one of the patient groups that were concerned were the long-term chronic patients, where informed consent had fallen off the radar a bit. And people had a sense that because they had a good rapport with the patients over many months, they stopped actively consenting them. Now, it didn't, yes, mean stopping everything, getting out forms, but to keep on re-explaining things or explaining as you would for new patients as you went along.
Yes.
So they became the neglected group. So,
well, there are those patients who clearly don't want you to go through that process. You know, so don't just get on with it and do what you need to do. And one can be perhaps a little bit too conscious of the need to explain everything over and over again to a patient who genuinely doesn't want that.
Absolutely. It's not everything. It's only relevant things, isn't,
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
It's the relevant things to the patient. So practical information on our next slide is that the first appointment tends to be reported as the hardest by practitioners. You don't always have the rapport you need to break various stages, and it takes time. The temptation to give this blanket consent before people come in, I expect you mentioned you've been discussing this a few weeks ago, it's not a helpful thing.
Right.
A blanket consent and then the patient walks in isn't getting anywhere near informed consent.
Does it contribute at all to the patient's psychological acceptance of treatment or acceptance of the practitioner that they've simply been through the process, even if it's not good in terms of getting consent in a legal manner? The fact that they have been asked up front, it's been explained up front, do they feel better about coming to you because of that?
I think the fact they're doing the consent form means they already feel good enough to come and see you.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, they do not like signing something before they've even spoken to you, and it actually adds a level of defensiveness. So,
but some people don't like the whole idea that you're signing something suggests that you're giving away responsibility or giving away authority, doesn't it? Which is, that must be quite nerve-wracking for some.
Absolutely, or that you're somehow letting them off responsibility. I think an information sheet before you come in is great, a well-written information sheet, saying this is what you can expect. But consent, it's not.
Indeed.
Only information. Conveying in words and numbers, I keep hinting at this, but we haven't got around to it. So that's the bit I want to talk about next. But it's going to take most of the time. So before I do that, giving and keeping a record is something we've also touched on. And in terms of what comes up in complaints panels is not so much whether consent was given, but lawyers pick on straight away as on miserable record keeping. So often when people record consent, they will put one line that said consent given.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if we go through the three-stage model of Elwin, you need to say something about you know, three lines maximum, but the options you discussed, the benefits, the realistic benefits you agreed on, the common risks you covered. Now, you may not want to kind of like write that all out in hand. You may already have an information sheet where you say, you know, went through information sheet A4 attached. You can do it like that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be. Doesn't have to be signed by the patient. But it does have to be enough information so if later on the patient said, I didn't realise that could happen, you can say, well, actually, we did discuss it and I've got it written in my notes.
Yeah.
So decision talk, next slide, is the final stage you're doing before you crack on with what you really want to do. And this is about guiding the patient to form their preferences. So what, from your point of view, matters most to you? And eliciting a preference, if they're going, oh, I don't know, it's up to you, it's just saying, well, would you like a moment to think about this? And it sounds ridiculous, and again, you'll probably say, well, what about the time in a clinical scenario?
Yes.
But I can think of a case for me as a patient, remember I'm the most difficult patient on the planet, where I needed a wisdom tooth removing, and I had a face like a hamster. And I've been in incredible pain for 3 weeks, and I had fought not to go to the dentist. He had tried me on various courses of antibiotics. It didn't reduce anything by a day, and on it went. And I was getting to the point where I was, you know, kind of like weak enough to agree to see a dentist properly. He said to me, the tooth needs to come out, but the risks are your jaw could be paralysed. And I thought, this will be a tragedy for mankind if I'm not still rambling. And so I thought, well, in that case, I won't have it done.
Yeah.
That's fine. I will stay in incredible pain and look like a hamster for the rest of my life. Now, you could have said, well, we discussed my options and I'd made my choice. What he did, knowing that my preference was quite a poor one, he said, first of all, he said, what's making you hesitate about having your tooth out? Because the risk of paralysis is tiny. And he did two things. He said, firstly, would you like a few minutes to think about this? And secondly, he said, I think I know why you're scared about this. Mm. And he produced the reason. He then put me back in the waiting room while he saw his next patient and said, why don't we meet again in 15 minutes? He did his other patient. He called me back in and I went, hur, hur, ar. And there was the end of the tooth.
Yes.
And that moment to just sit there thinking, yeah, it's about fear, it's not about clear decision making, was brilliant.
Yeah.
Didn't interrupt his schedule, he just swapped us for moments. And I think these kind of things you might not need to use more often than once in 100 patients, but knowing it's there in your armoury is quite a sensible approach.
Yeah.
Do you have that? Do you have patients needing a thinking moment?
I haven't actually offered that opportunity to patients myself, I must say. I think, well, I mean, let's take, we had Stephen Sandler on one of these broadcasts a few months ago, and he was talking about PR techniques, when the norm is, the guidelines from the General Counsel are, that you should always give people a period of time, not just 5 minutes in the waiting room, but some days to think about whether they genuinely want to undergo PR techniques. But he doesn't, because a lot of his patients are coming from Scotland or wherever else, and therefore they have to get all their information in advance and be able to make that informed decision before they arrive in the clinic or whatever. But I think, I don't think I've ever come across a situation where a patient has needed that degree of thinking time, or at least I haven't perceived it. I have had patients say that they don't want any manipulation or don't want cervical manipulation, which is fine, and we can go on and do something else. And I've always taken the view that I don't try to discourage them from that view. If they've made the decision that they think the risks are too great, even though I've explained the risks are tiny, I don't want to put myself in a position where people might suggest that I have tried to influence that decision, because it is their decision, isn't it?
I can think of two cases where the patient was offered cranial osteopathy and they didn't expect that. They wanted something much more painful and clicky.
Yes.
And in both cases, you know, it was offered and they went along with the decision and they went away resenting it, feeling that they hadn't got their money's worth. And for them, actually something had gone wrong in the agreement process.
Yes. Okay.
Because they came out saying that wasn't real osteopathy. That's not what they've gone for.
Yeah, and that is a problem, isn't it? Because I think many patients will come in wanting to be clunked and clicked and feel a difference immediately, even if it's not a complete fix. And cranial osteopathy does definitely need to be explained in that regard to those types of patients. Yeah.
So realistic expectations.
How are we getting on? We're chatting away here. Are we anywhere near the number of slides you wanted to get through this evening?
No. Far too much chatting, not enough cracking on. Right. I've talked about the record of consent and notes on X-Slides. Can give consent orally. I personally like it. I think it works well. Mm. We've talked about the problems with blanket forms. We've talked about information sheets can be very useful as long as they're well worded. But the clinician has to record the consenting process in a fairly detailed way. More detail you can put in. But I'm thinking a couple of lines. Whenever I've been on cases with poor consenting, people are talking about two or three words. And we discuss this in public with the GCC, and people said, I know you say that, but that's not what the councils are saying. But the councils both times said, no, that is what we're saying. If you talk about the three things I've mentioned, that's about as much as you'd expect on a conduct committee.
If in a given clinic, which may be one or more practitioners, it is the standard practice that there is a four or five letter abbreviation which stands for those two lines of things that you've said, is that acceptable?
As long as somewhere else you've attached the full sheet.
Right.
Okay. So if you say, I went through the standard risks for C sheet A4, and you clip that into the notes, that's okay. It's not a handwriting exercise, it's a recording exercise.
Yeah. I'm just thinking we're talking about getting consent quite regularly for treatment, and I ask patients every single time I want to manipulate a neck, I'll ask them for their consent to do that. But I don't write in my notes every single time that I did that.
But presumably, it's pretty much the same risks for each neck patient.
Yes.
So you could just have a neck information sheet that you call, that you label, and then you just clip that on. So next slide, we're going to start looking now at how you talk about risks and or side effects more often, or avoid the word completely. Now, I want to talk about this about in terms of bias. How do you present this information neutrally? Or are there any times where you particularly want to change people's effect? So on the whole, using words works well for people. So the kind of language of risk on this slide mentions words like likely, possible, probable. You know, it's quite likely that you might feel a bit stiff after treatment. In rare cases, you might find that. And on the whole, that works well for people to a point. But obviously, what I think of as likely may be very different to you. So I'm going to put you on the spot now, as you put me on the spot earlier. It's like, what do you think frequent and rarely are as a percentage?
Gosh, frequent, above 50%, rarely below 10%.
Okay. So this is what the public say. Frequent they described as 70%.
Well, what do they know?
With a range of 30 to 90.
Right.
And rare, doctors described as 5%.
Okay.
Now, personally, if they said there's, you know, people rarely die, 5%, I think I would absolutely flee from their surgery. So obviously it is context specific.
My experience, people always die, don't they?
They do, they do.
Just not always in surgery.
But I think, you know, kind of like, we know that it's context, it's very subject specific. But the same point, obviously, what I think and what you think is different.
Yeah.
Now, what happens psychologically is you say to me, it's rare. I think in my head, okay, rare for me is about 0.01%. And then later I think, but you said it was 0.01%. You think, no, I didn't. How did you remember that? So I can actually remember doing this when I was being consented, and they said, you have a 1% chance of something happening. And I took that to be a high percent, because I thought 1% of dying is high in my book. And I said, but you said there was a high percent chance of me dying from this treatment. He went, no, I didn't. Yeah. And I went, yes, we did. No, we didn't. And then my partner said to, actually, 1%. And he said, you did say 1%, and to Pippa, that's high. And we needed a translator.
Yeah, I'm struggling now, because earlier on you said, don't use percentages. And a moment ago you said, well, people's interpretation of rarely or hardly ever or whatever is different.
So both. You've got to do both.
Okay. So, oh, dear, oh, dear.
Because this process is going on in our heads.
Yes.
So I think the point is there's huge personal variation. If you give words, people translate it into number. If you give numbers, they translate it into words. So you're trying to get to a point where people realise what you're dealing with. If there's numbers, if there's no numbers, or not specific numbers, there's no point in using them at all.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to, where we can, use numbers alongside words, but without making it
complicated. What about comparable risks then? For example, it's been common practice, I think, for many years for people to say the risk of you suffering a stroke as a result of cervical manipulation is higher when you have your hair washed over the sink in a hairdresser's than it is in osteopathic or chiropractic treatment.
People do use those.
Mm.
I think on the whole, comparative risks work best when you're comparing like with like. So
we should be saying it's more risky with chiropractors than osteopaths?
No,
we don't mean that at all.
And so if you think, well, that's a very comparable thing, the hairdresser and my treatment,
right, okay,
then I think it's a fair comparison.
So we can make that comparison then, because when you say the risk is in having your head backward bent for a period of time, and that's more likely to happen than having your hair washed.
If you've got solid evidence for claiming that.
Yeah.
Then I think that's a reasonable comparison. You know, people will say the risk of doing this treatment is comparable to doing exercise, or the risk of improvement or increased pain is comparable.
Right. Yeah.
I think where you don't want to do comparisons is jokey comparisons. Mm. So, you know, you're more likely to be kicked to death by a donkey than to suffer paralysis from this treatment. It makes for a funny moment, but it's not helping someone to think clearly about whether they want to take that risk or not.
Yeah. Okay.
And the only time you'll revisit that is if something goes wrong. And if in your notes you said, well, I told them the donkey thing, you know, it's kind of like, did that really help them to decide?
Yes.
So a meaningful comparison. Okay. Some people say never use comparisons, but I think something that puts things in perspective is no bad thing.
Well, given what you said about numbers and interpretation of words, it seems to me that it's possibly the most sensible route to go down.
Yeah.
Yes. Provided we have, you say, as you say, have got a meaningful comparison.
Yeah, based on something strong.
Yeah.
So my next slide, the emotions of numbers. So we're already saying that people feel numbers very differently. So I'd like you to look at these. You're on the spot, you're my stooge for this evening, to look at four sentences and just read them to yourself. 1 in 10 women get breast cancer. There's a 10% chance of getting breast cancer. 9 out of 10 women do not get breast cancer. There's a 1 in 10 chance that you will get breast cancer. So each of these four presentations will make you feel differently. So maybe breast cancer is much lower thing, but
prostate cancer,
if it makes it closer to home. 1 in 10 men get prostate cancer.
Do you know, I think I'm sufficiently numerate to put them all into a very similar context, but the nicest way of saying it is that 9 out of 10 don't get the problem to me.
Hmm. So that's the one people tend to like. Or 1 in 10 people get prostate cancer. Which sounds it's more likely to happen to you? 1 in 10 men get prostate cancer, or there's a 10% chance of getting prostate cancer. Which sounds like it's more likely to happen to you?
I think to me, 1 in 10, but again, I would probably immediately put it in those terms anyway.
Exactly. So that's what the research shows, that by using numbers, say 1 in 10, it brings it closer, it makes it real. I understand that that's something that could happen to me.
And I think that would be much more, I'm guessing that would be much more the case for someone who is not particularly numerate.
Yeah. So small denominators and frequencies works better for most people.
Okay.
And if we're, what we're trying to do is get people to know what they're letting themselves in for, then that's what you're going for.
Yeah.
If you want people to distance from the information, then your percentages let people distance. 10%, well, I'm not 10%, I'm me. And it makes people further away from the message.
Yeah.
So my next slide is a summary of this. Frequencies, more individual, more individually orientated, that brings the message home. Obviously, using you brings the message closer still.
Yes.
You will get prostate cancer. It's much more personal than men get prostate cancer. And the advice is to do positive and negative pairing. So 1 in 10 might, 1 in 10 will get this effect.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, means that 9 out of 10 won't. And it helps people to balance.
Yeah.
And this is where you really want to make a specific thing clear. Percentages are loved because they sound scientific, they look more mathematical. People are very tempted to do them on information sheets. They're great for published journals. On information sheets, still frequencies make more sense. Right. They help people to understand what they're doing.
We actually had a question about something you were saying just a few seconds ago. And it's one of the predictable sort of question is that some examples from you of how this process has broken down. Have you got some examples of the sort of thing which has led to a complaint which has been not necessarily upheld, but has had to be investigated because people have been getting this wrong? Juicy stories, I think, is what people are asked after.
Oh, a juicy story. I think in the, in the complaints, people say, I wouldn't have had this treatment if I'd known that the success was so unlikely.
Okay.
So we had one case, which of course is all in the public arena, with a chiropractor, where it involved taking a blood sample, sealing it in a bag, and putting it on the top of someone's head. Now there was more to this than meets the eye.
I'm not familiar with this story at all.
But this has got to be one of the juiciest cases I listened to. And the point of this was because he couldn't explain to the panel how this treatment was affecting the body. If he couldn't explain it to us, then he presumably couldn't get informed consent from the patient.
Right.
Therefore, it was not a good treatment.
What was the purpose?
The idea.
You couldn't understand. So.
Well, the idea, I think, was that the blood sample, the external blood and the internal blood, would create a tension and it would enable him to find out where the problem was within the body. It was a very specific technique he'd learnt from America.
Well, there you are. I mean, you might not have been expecting to learn new techniques in watching this this broadcast, but there's one for you if you care to try that. Please.
Well, with that case, there was no attempt whatsoever to explain the realistic benefits or the risks. Now, obviously, I don't think there was any risks of harm other than loss of income and prolonged symptoms. So the very thing she needed help for.
Okay, well, there's an issue in actually taking blood, isn't there? I mean, there's a risk of some sort of harm in that. And what I imagine, was that explained properly to the patient?
Not at all. I don't think there was any consenting in this particular case.
Okay.
So I don't know. Dodgy examples. They're lovely to look up.
But that was a donkey-kicking example you gave us there, wasn't it? Because it wasn't...
Yeah.
You know, that was quite extreme, really.
People do use that in consenting, though. They do it to reduce tension, to make people laugh.
No, sorry, I mean, I asked you for an example, and you said someone took some blood and put a bag of blood on someone's head. Mm. Well, I don't know anybody who's ever done that, so have you got an example?
I do.
You do? Okay, well, we all do now. Right.
So, percentage is meaningful, because sometimes people do use percentages, or they get them from papers, and that's... who they're talking to. And I think the point is about using percentages is, one, who are you talking to, and what's the purpose of giving the percentage, and in particular, percentage of what?
Yes.
And so the more we try and create evidence in chiropractic and osteopathy, the more people are pulling in percentages to kind of give credence to the effect. And I'm loving the evidence, I'm loving seeing that we're getting measurable things. But when you actually look at the way these percentages are produced, a lot of it looks a bit dotty to me.
Mm.
And this is both as a researcher and as a patient. So I've given us three examples to talk about. Less than 1% of patients experience moderate adverse effects, such as troublesome pain, numbness or tingling, lasting weeks or months. 99% of patients do not have these adverse effects. Now, I took this out of a patient information leaflet.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts to you about the use of percentages here?
Well, it seems quite clear to me. I mean, I understand the ratio there. As a practitioner, I think arguably I'd say it's quite a high percentage, but that's not the point of the question, is it?
Mm.
Yeah, I understand that perfectly well. I'm assuming the percentages are accurate in terms of this example.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, I would rather have 1 in 100.
Mm-hmm.
1 in 100 patients experience it. I would cut out words such as adverse effects. Just 1 in 100 patients have reported some pain, numbness or tingling lasting for weeks and months.
Hmm.
However, 99% have not.
Yeah.
I think...
I suppose...
where you can get rid of jargon and where you can have frequencies.
Yeah.
It clarifies things.
I suppose the obvious question that a sensible patient would ask on that is, well, what happened to those ones who had it for a couple of weeks? Did that mean that treatment was working and it was just there was an effect, or did that mean that the treatment had gone wrong but whatever had gone wrong fixed itself after a few weeks?
Or did it mean they got it forever? So you do want to know the outcome. The next example, 50% of patients achieved at least a 30% decrease in symptoms.
Yeah, that's tough, isn't it? That's struggling at anyone to work the mathematics out on that one.
Well, so. Like the 30% decrease in symptoms. Does that mean I had 100 symptoms and now I've only got 70?
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, whenever you talk about a 30% decrease in pain, which is our next example, reduced back pain by 30%, I would really struggle to talk about decrease in pain in those figures.
Yeah. So would you then say, well, we get outcome measures from a certain percentage of our patients, and most of them would say that on a scale of 1 to 10, their pain had gone from 10 to 3 after treatment or after so many
that
treatments.
That makes it clearer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Much clearer.
Yeah.
You know, and in terms of a 30% decrease in symptoms, actually, so over half patients said that some of their symptoms had got better. Yeah. Makes more sense to me. Not all their symptoms, but some of their symptoms. Yeah. Over half, give me a rough idea. So back to sort of just ordinary language. And part of this, with our next slide, is about the difference between absolute and relative figures.
Mm-hmm.
Relative risks exaggerate, as we know. So pharmacy companies, advertising, media, they thrive on these things. You're 5 times more likely to get, you know, osteopathy is 5 times more successful than. They don't really help. We need to keep things as absolutes while it's fun exaggerating, and I do it a million times.
Yeah, I mean, I saw an advert for something medical in a journal the other day. It wasn't one of the osteopathic or chiropractic journals, but it was saying blood when you clean your teeth could be a sign of this. And you thought, well, of course it could. It could be a sign of all sorts of things. But, I mean, it was designed to make
heart
you buy...
Heart failure, I think. Was it? It probably was, wasn't it?
No, it was all about a bacteria between your teeth causing your gums to rot or something. But, you know, of course it could be that. But it was designed to make you buy this particular strange product. I think it was in the Telegraph magazine, so...
Well, I think not to fall into that
which
trap.
I hasten to add my father brought for me, because I don't get the Telegraph myself, but...
Apologies to your dad. So averages and ranges, our next slide. I mean, that's quite interesting because people fear anything that smacks of stats. But actually, put into human language, it can be okay. So it can be part of realistic expectations for benefits as well as for risks. And it can normalise things. So because I've been a mother for many years, I had to give you one potty example. The average age for potty training is 2.5 years. The normal time for potty training is 18 months to 8 years. Now, if anyone hasn't had children yet, that should make you wheeze with fear.
Yes.
Normal up to 8 years.
Yeah.
But isn't that quite a nice way, I took that out of a paediatric manual, quite a nice way of making people who might be anxious about being at the upper end of the continuum feel normal.
Yes, it makes you feel very good as well if your children were potty trained at the age of 2.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We're ahead of the game already.
And so in our situation, most patients get some increase in movement with 3 to 6 sessions. Some have reported an immediate difference and others said it took longer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, so you know, when you get to your 6th session, it might still take another couple to pan out on that.
Okay.
So it's, and again, people expect some very instant changes. So we're seeing this in medicine as well as in the manual therapies, but where people want, you know, people assume that a severe illness will clear up in a week. Or if I've got a cough, it will take a week. Well, coughs tend to take 4 weeks to 8 weeks. And yet, as a culture now, we expect instant fixes, instant recovery.
Yes.
And people go back to the doctor saying, I think there's something really wrong. My cough has lasted 6 weeks.
Mm.
And they're going, yes, well, normally it would take between 4 and 8 weeks. That's very expected.
But at the same time, we're all now increasingly aware, I think, maybe it's just people involved in medicine, we're all increasingly aware that the products designed to fix your cough are actually, by and large, of no use whatsoever. And you said about antibiotics, and well, maybe your sore throat will be one day shorter in duration because you've had antibiotics, but you know, we're now all aware of that, so maybe we ought to be more accepting of the fact that the cough will go on for a few weeks.
Well, I think if you're told at the beginning, then you don't trail back to your doctor after 4 weeks wanting inhalers and asthma tests and so on. So, and I think that assumption you're saying we're all aware, you're aware, but someone else might not be. Yeah. I'm aware now of the antibiotics, but even though I've been working in this field for a few months, I wasn't aware at the beginning of this that it's one miserable day difference.
I've got a particular sort of bone of contention, not a bone of contention, a hobby horse, is that I once went, I had a cold, and I went to Waitrose to get Lemsip or something like that, and there were about three or four different Lemsips. There's one for catarrh, and there's one for this type of cold, and there's one for flu, and I looked at the ingredients on them, and they're all exactly the same, despite the fact that the prices were vastly different.
Honey?
No, there wasn't any active, well, I don't know if honey counts as an active ingredient, but there weren't any differences in the active ingredients at all. And yet they were vastly different in price. So I think one was £3 for the same amount of sachets, and one was 10 or something. Or
nicer
eight.
Packaging?
Yeah, it was nicer packaging. Yes,
excellent,
it was blue.
You see?
Yeah, it was blue.
Blue,
yeah.
There you
so,
see, it's really magical.
When you come to designing your website, that's the answer. It's have a blue website and charge an extra £8 per trip.
Google changed the shade of blue on their first letter by a nano shade, and the hits on their site increased vastly.
I don't believe that.
It was a Google guy who told us. Google
well, it
marketing.
Would be. They would. They have to justify the expenditure, wouldn't they?
Anyway, use blue. Right, next slide. Visual representation. So we're trying to make things as clear as possible. And so visuals work very well for most of us. Again, you know, if we look at this circle here, benefits are jumping out more than problems. And that's so helpful. No change, benefits, problem. You can see it's really skinny. It's a very, very quick way of explaining to people. And they can see that even if something goes wrong, it's quite possible it can go wrong, but you weren't expecting it, but you did warn them.
Yes.
So very nice. If you're comparing two treatments, then having two bars is a nice way of doing it. As you can see, they're about the same risks or they're about the same effectiveness. A fast way of doing it. And it doesn't matter whether they're printed or if you draw it out in really scrappy pencil. Just getting something on paper helps people
to think about. I suspect there's going to be quite a few people thinking, well, yes, it might not take long to tell people this in clinic, but it's going to take me a very long time to do all the research necessary to get this information in order to produce the pie charts or the bar graphs or whatever.
Nice papers are coming out now, so people are beginning to publish ways of doing this, about sharing information sheets, sharing particular things, and the more we can share this stuff,
Can we put some links to that up from our website after this?
Leach is working on this. I think her team in Brighton, and I know the Osteopathic Association funded a whole series of papers, didn't they, about getting this information out in public arena, and it's ongoing. Good. I've seen a huge change in literature in 3 years, which has been great. Now, you talked about rare things, so risks of serious effects that are rare but very serious do need to be mentioned. And here's two graphical ways we've got on this slide about mentioning them. So the big circle with a tiny red dot in it shows that...
I can't see the red dot.
Good. It's tiny. but it shows that it's out there. Or I think maybe I need to make my red dot more obvious. But, you know, your example will have one on. And the chances are you won't be that red dot, but it is there and you have discussed it.
Yeah.
I think that's a very nice way of putting it in perspective for people. And to me, that works much better than saying 10 in 10,000. Or you can do it with lots and lots of little blobs and have just one dot. So again, on the one on the left, we've got one tiny dot. And you can see most people won't have that problem, but it could happen to me.
Yes.
What you don't want to do is to diminish the information in any way. So smiley faces, little dancing stick people, I'm quite wary of, because the second time you'll be reviewing this information is if something's gone wrong. So if someone's paralysed and you pull out information sheet A4 and it's got little smiley faces and one downward face, it feels very uncomfortable.
Yes.
So visual good, but neutral good too. And my next slide is just warning you that while stick figures or faces can be helpful, be very wary of them. Mm. Keep them for simple things. Make them for things that couldn't end up disastrously. For certain types of groups, they are perceived differently. So in groups with lower education, they then are seen, people see things as high risk.
Yes.
So you might do better with your big green circle and some red dots in it. The way you group things makes people see things differently.
Okay.
So if you've got sets of charts and say 5%, 5 in 100, and you have out of 100 little faces or squares, you have your 5 in a line, people see that you could dodge that 5 and be in the safe area.
Mm-hmm.
So they perceive that as lower risk than if your 5
are dotted around.
Things are dotted yes. around, where you can yeah. see you could stumble across that easily. Yeah. So that could be me.
Yeah.
And you are trying to make people see
yes.
it could be for them. And I think perhaps my last slide is being aware of your own resistance. So lots of these things you think, oh, I don't need to go through the risks. Actually, you do. That is part of the process. You need to go through the relevant risks to that patient. And that's for everyone. That is part of informed consent.
So, as you say, we are coming to the end of our time on air this evening, and we will put up a summary of what you've said in a few days' time, so that people can, they'll hear the questions, they'll hear what you've said, they'll see the graphics that you've put up. Can you draw that together in a couple of minutes that we've got left and say, this is what you would expect practitioners to do physically in their clinic to make consent the consenting process better or more robust?
I would say think of it as Elwin's 3-stage process.
Mm-hmm.
So you're starting off, you're making someone comfortable, you're making sure that they're in the right frame of mind to be able to listen.
Yes.
You're giving them thinking time. So you're doing the settling, you're explaining to them what they need to know and the decisions they've got to make. You're encouraging them to take an active part in that, mm-hmm. and you're checking that if they want to pull themselves away from that, and some do, that they're doing that because they really do want you to make the decision and not because there's anxiety.
Yes.
And you're checking throughout that they know what they're doing
and
why.
Underlying it, our information to patients and our record of the information that we've provided is reasonably robust and accurate as well.
Yeah.
Reasonably is absolutely accurate.
Great if you've got information sheets that they can read before, during, after.
Yes.
Essential that you have records written that shows that you've gone through each stage, that you have given the diagnosis, of course,
mm-hmm.
That you have explained the most significant treatments and given them a choice, and you have given them the benefits, the realistic benefits, and the risks before they make their final choice.
Yeah. This will come as a challenge to many osteopaths and probably chiropractors and physios as well, because I've worked in a number of practices and many of us are guilty of very, very, very abbreviated notes where we simply scribble what we did, and I think on many occasions we forget to say the important stuff that we've communicated with patients. So maybe that is a lesson to take away as a result of this evening's presentation. I think there's no doubt that all of that was extremely interesting information, extremely relevant to what we do, and important both in keeping us safe in the eyes of the law, but also in setting our minds at rest that what we're doing is actually sound procedure and would stand up should there ever be some sort of inquiry. I'm going to call it to a halt there. I apologise to anyone whose question wasn't asked this evening. If you'd like to send them in to me, I'm sure that I will be able to get answers for you. As I've said, the broadcast will be summarised on the website in due course, and there will be references, as Pippa has explained as she went along, so that you can click to the relevant links and draw out the information for yourselves. Our next broadcast is on the 18th of this month. We're going down to Chippenham to Herman Miller's headquarters. Herman Miller's the manufacturers of some very high quality and very sophisticated office furniture, where we are talking to an expert in ergonomics. And there are some things which I know will come out of there which will be interesting and surprising, and we will be putting up some free offers on the website as well during that broadcast, which you can hand out to patients, which you can use yourselves. And I know it will be a fascinating broadcast, just as fascinating as this evening's has been. But thank you very much indeed for your time and for coming in to see us.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I hope you enjoyed it as well.
I did.